Undead creatures of the night feeding on the vital essence of the living. Vampires have captured the imagination of people for millennia. Popularized in large part by the works of Bram Stoker and Anne Rice, vampires have entered the modern collective consciousness as a staple of horror and dark fantasy, including the tabletop games of those respective genres such as Dungeons & Dragons and Vampire the Masquerade. Welcome back to Legends and Lore, everyone. I'm Renazuo, joined today by my fellow lore keeper, Tom Sweeney, and a special guest specialized in the field of role-playing and vampires, B. Dave Walters. Glad to have you here today, bud.
Glad to have you here, man.
Hi. That's the dozens and the dozens of my fans out there. Yeah. No.
I've got tens of fans.
Exactly. Thank you guys for having me here. Obviously, vampires and the vampire mythos is very near and dear to my heart.
Yeah. Sween loves them. Sween loves them.
Yeah, I adore vampires. They're my favorite. I
love that we're getting this track record on the show of doing episodes of things that you're just like repulsed by, like when we did the Illithids.
Oh man, I like vampires more than like Illithids. I couldn't feed a starving lithid. I couldn't do it. My heart would be like,
you can feed a starving.
Oh no, I am capable of doing it. I just would not.
You got what they want. Yeah.
you got that good stuff that they want. So, So for vampires, like I said earlier to you guys, I want to kind of jump around a little bit because we've got great stuff both in D&D and other lore and stuff like that, and then later we'll have some questions, but where I would like to start is, what do you think is the quintessential setting for vampires? It's got to be Ravenloft for D&D.
I was about to say, Abby, you got to pare that down.
Yeah, for D&D.
And everything.
Like Transylvania. We're just like naming places.
Well, of course. In actuality, yes.
Ravenloft. Sir, yeah. Ravenloft. I mean, there was vampires back to the earliest edition of this game, back to first edition, but they were just monsters you could encounter anywhere. And then Ravenloft was one of the earliest it was an adventure first, and then became its own independent setting soon after that, and blossomed and mutated into the delightfully terrible thing we know today.
That would probably be kind of the genesis of where you start seeing the evil vampire as a character in D&D, as opposed to just a monster that you're there to take out.
Which they are.
Monsters. I mean, they're there for you to try. They're not that. Yeah. In the earliest time of the game, a lot of what it was let's take this thing from pop culture and mythology that people know and then figure out how to express it in a legally distinct way in this game.
Yeah,
right.
Ravenloft and Strahd were always Transylvania and Dracula, always. Mm-hmm. For you to be able to go and tell that story at your table. It's just, again, legally distinct.
a land covered in mist, that the people there are sad, and there's barely any sun, and there's a vampire on top of a hill in a huge manor. It's like, oh, that doesn't sound familiar at all to me.
desperately searching for this one woman. Right. Yeah. And has this one human guy who is a vampire hunter who has sworn to destroy him, and they have a semi-eternal beef. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now
it's not me when you hear something you know.
I realize that Strahd has an origin very similar to Dracula, but I seem to remember, legally distinct. I seem to remember there being different origins for him at one point in time. I don't know if that was across like different editions of the game.
Is it Strahd?
Yeah, like I seem to remember there being other origins for him that they like tried out that did not stick. Because am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, there's been 50 years of this. I mean, when he first showed up, it was I'm a vampire because reasons. You know, I'm the first vampire, no less. You know, it wasn't until the novel I, Strahd came out, which was years later, that really kind of fleshed out and solidified, you know, his exact story and everything about Sergei and the formation of the lands of Barovia and the whole "I am the land" quote and all of that stuff came from I, Strahd later on. Before now, that was before
the Domains of Dread, right? If I'm not mistaken, that was even before the Domains of Dread became like a proper thing. It was just like only Ravenloft.
I think
and then,
yeah, there was Ravenloft. Well, the original Ravenloft. I have to, you know, say that carefully because that it grew and became its own thing. Was the whole place was like you could go look at the old first and second edition maps. And it's a kingdom like anywhere else. Like, well, here's Barovia, and over there is Darkon, and over there is Falkovnia, and you kind of can't leave, and it kind of sucks, but, you know, here we are. This idea of it being more like a system of dirty bubbles that kind of rub up against each other is fairly new with Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft.
I like that phrasing.
The first to, like, really put these impenetrable walls around each domain is a fairly new addition.
Yeah, because it used to be, I remember in second edition, back when I would play that, it was possible to traverse them, but you had to, like, it was very special circumstances. Like, you had to meet special requirements to be able to, and essentially, the individual domains have to let you go. And that's not common. It's pretty rare. I remember reading that book, I, Strahd, because I got really into the Ravenloft books when I was in high school. And the one that always sticks out to me is when Lord Soth gets pulled into into Barovia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that one, as him just kind of like, you know, beating the hell out of Strahd's defenses in his castle with like a giant like Bigby's crushing hand or something like that. It was a very cool book, but it's the only part that I've like retained over the years.
Yeah, we're having audio issues.
Yeah,
I thought it was me. I was being quiet.
Did he kind of bottom out for a minute for you?
Yeah, he did.
Oh,
okay.
I mean, you're recording locally, so I think your point will still be made.
Yeah,
but I mean, I can't respond to it. I'm just gonna be like, yeah, absolutely.
I was just staying quiet. I was like, I'm not gonna say anything. I'm not gonna interrupt him. I'm just gonna listen.
Yeah, that's all good. Technical issues aside, though, Ravenloft has always been kind of like. It was unfortunate because I feel like in third edition they kind of fell off of it, and then fourth edition it didn't really exist. Like, they didn't do anything with it. So it was one of the things about fifth edition that I liked was it coming back and getting new life breathed into it.
Yeah, or, you know, unlife into it, such as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Curse of Strahd was a very effective way to reintroduce the setting for a new generation of people that didn't know what it was, or that it was there, or who Strahd was. And, you know, then Van Richten's Guide took that and kind of expanded it out where you can really tell whatever story that you want to tell there, which has been a really, really fantastic and powerful reintroduction, for sure.
Mm-hmm. For sure. It's really, really cool. I played a little bit of 3.5, and then I really jumped in 4E. I jumped in at 5e. My friends refused to play 4th edition for some reason. I didn't know why.
We do not speak of 4th edition, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I get it now somewhat, but I'm like, we could have played it, tried to do it. Like, nah, never. So I recently got... So I didn't really know much about vampires along the lines of Strahd, but I played Curse of Strahd through and through, and I was like, I still argue it's like one of the best adventures that 5e's put out. I'd argue it's like, it's maybe top two.
Yeah.
I would say even like a very reaching argument for something else. And I really enjoy, like, as someone that's not a huge fan of like vampires, you know, I'm not a big fan of like Dampier's, huge fan. Eric Brooks, one of my favorite characters. But when it comes to regular vampires, I've not been a huge fan of them. But I really enjoyed Strahd and his pretty much the way the world tells his story and the way that vampires are used in those narratives, where it's sort of like They are ever present, but they are also enigmatic at the same time. Yeah. It's also such a very cool way of being using an enemy or a character in general. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate what they did with them.
Well, okay. So let me zone of safety, zone of safety. I don't like zombies. I think zombies are really stupid.
And I
don't like
zombies. I agree.
So, me too, actually. You're good.
What is it about vampires that don't do it for you?
I don't know, man. I've always been more of a werewolf guy, you know. The duality of man and beast, I've always been way more of a fan of, you know.
Yeah.
I just felt, sorry to interrupt you, Ren, my bad, if you're going to say something.
No, you're good. But
because vampires have always seemed so, they're so powerful. They're such like an extremely powerful like kind of creature, but yet I feel like their weaknesses, like back hearkening to the Superman thing, are just so kind of silly. It's like you are faster and stronger and more magically inclined than any being relative, most beings that exist. Yet if you fall in a stream of running water, you'll be hurt, or you can't get a tan, you know. And these are just me being silly, but those things have never really hearkened to me. But then when it comes to half vampires, I adore them. Like, I think they're the coolest. Like, freaking Alucard. I love Alucard. He's like one of the coolest characters to me, I think.
Yeah. You're talking about the Castlevania Alucard, right?
Well, yes. And obviously, like, Helsing's pretty cool also. And then, like, just the Dampier side. Yeah. I really like Dampier. I think they're so cool.
Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about, because before, I would say it was when I got into Vampire the Masquerade was when I started actually considering the idea of vampires as fully fleshed characters who aren't necessarily just driven wholly by hunger and can actually have like other motivations and other things that they want, you know, going in their lives. So I always thought that was pretty interesting. And then when I came back to D&D, because I took like a few years off from Dungeons & Dragons and just not playing it. And when I came back to it, I really felt like I was able to tackle vampires not just as enemies, but as possible protagonists again as a, I don't know, as someone, something that could be three-dimensional, you know?
As an aside, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, oh, they're still driven by hunger.
Oh, yeah.
True, yes.
When I think of any of the magified humans, you know, where the idea, they're not human blood with, like, something else. When I think of, like, the magified humans, like lycanthropes or vampires, I, as characters within most regular times, I'm like, hey, you can't do that because this curse really will warp your character. Like, I think the reason why most vampires are crazy is because, like, they have human minds with this eternal existence and, like, a ravenous hunger for flesh. So, like, even the most good guy vampire will eventually kind of go nutty, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's an eventual thing, I feel. I'm not Dendo B on that. I'm sure B. Dave has way more information about it, because I've watched Vampire Masquerade many a times, and the way you guys tackle your vampires, the way, like, especially my favorite thing is the hierarchy of vampires has always been super interesting to me.
You mean like how they interact with each other?
Well, how there's like literally like a, like almost a monarchy level to them. I think that's very interesting.
Mm. Yeah, like the Camarilla structure with the princes and stuff. So, you know, what's interesting is, so the World of Darkness landed on my face when I was in high school when it came out, because I was absolutely the target demographic. And actually, I was a werewolf fan before I was a vampire fan, because even then, where you were like, let me get this straight, I can be like sexy and seductive and filled with ennui, or I can be a 10-foot rage monster that can throw pickup trucks. Like, yeah, no, give me that. So, you know, I had to represent for the Shadow Lords even before I represented for Clan Ventru, mm-hmm. Which is Shadow Lords is still one of the best names of all time.
Nice.
And the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize about Vampire the Masquerade in particular is how much that story has affected the pop culture perception of vampires for the last 30, 35 years. Every single vampire story that has come out since has been touched by that. It's why Underworld was so much stole the World of Darkness core concept.
Practically a carbon copy.
The world is in darkness.
They literally lost the lawsuit that it was like, you know, you just kind of like plagiarized all this. So, True Blood, Twilight, all of it came from Vampire the Masquerade. In one of the things that is in there, so in the game, in 5th edition, and even in previous editions, but especially in 5th edition, you have a rating of humanity. And it is pretty easy to lose humanity. It is very, 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 very hard to get it back. What a lot of people don't realize, and when your humanity has reached to zero, you are what is called a wight. You are just a mindless monster. Mm-hmm. But it also says that over a certain period of time, you lose humanity no matter what, no matter what you do. So if you live long enough, that's the fate of every vampire. Every kindred will end up there eventually. If you just keep living long enough, just the time and reality of what you are and what you are doing and what the beast wants from you and what the beast compels you to do will ultimately destroy you no matter what. And I think that is kind of a fantastic bit of tragic backdrop that is very often overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you basically have to try and keep engaged with your own humanity in order to keep it going.
I tell people that you know, it's a storytelling game of personal horror. Mm-hmm. You are a monster and you don't want to be. That's the game.
It makes sense because even if the idea of like, even like, and this is a bit of a stretch, but like the mentality of Dr. Manhattan, you know, the things he does, you to a degree, you transcend humanity, you know? Yep. And the longer you are in that state, the more it's just going to get confusing. Because you eventually realize that, like, oh, this is all sort of like the squabbles we have in this world right now. Most of them are simply just ridiculous, you know? And imagine living through dozens and dozens and dozens of them all across the world, just seeing, like, idiocy happen over and over and over again to the point you're just like, people are stupid. Like, I can't even want to eat them because of how dumb they are. I feel like I'm doing a disservice by ingesting them. You know?
Someone like, sounds like someone's sounding a little Ventru right now, actually.
Tired of Earth. These people tired of being caught in the tangle of their lives.
Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect that aspect of it. You know, I respect the idea, or even the vampire that is good, you know, the one that tries and stays and tries to be altruistic even in their time of them detaching from the more humane way. It's still them being like, I still can't get why these things are happening. Like, aren't they learning from what's gone on? And it's that is where the interest comes in, because the idea of the immortal character along with the vampire is interesting with the whole, it's an interesting dichotomy, which I will admit. I just like my wolf boys better.
I mean, you might have to preach the gospel of Clan Gangrel to you later. You can have a little bit of both, you know?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, see, now that's cool.
A little bit of both. I'm going to hit you guys with a question here that's actually kind of related on what we've been talking about, because we're talking about like the differences between, you know, these vampire depictions and how we see them. And I'll post it in the chat here so you guys can read it. But it comes from Twitter, username Rafa. So, do you like the way vampires are portrayed in D&D? Are there any changes you would make to them, or are you content with how they are now?
You know, again, they're legally distinct Dracula, so I get why they are how they are. I think the one thing that has never clearly been expressed is how you create a vampire in Dungeons & Dragons. It's clear how to create a vampire spawn. It's implied it requires biting 3 times, and that's just because in the Curse of Strahd, Strahd has already bitten Arena twice when you meet her, and when he bites her the 3rd time, it's a wrap. But it'd be great if maybe that was just like written somewhere. You know what I mean? That you're like, yeah, on the third day, they're going to bury him in the dirt. And then, you know, when the sun goes down, they're going to rise as a vampire. Something, you know? That's not in there.
Yeah, that would be a nice thing to have.
For me, I would like, I don't know, like, I want the scale of vampires. You know, I want like the Igors, the what are they called? Thralls. I want thralls. And then I want like young vampires, and I want some like ancient bad news. Like this guy, because I understand vampires within D&D are usually the idea of like already a long-lived vampire to the point that they've already warped the world around them. The magic that they are has seeped into the world, and it's affecting the world around them. But I want like bad news, because technically Strahd is the oldest vampire, right?
In the first realm. Vampire. He's the first. Mm-hmm.
But the idea of Strahd is that since he's in Ravenloft, time moves differently, technically, I guess. So he may not be the longest lived, but he was the first to be transformed, I guess. If that makes any sense.
He's kind of stuck in a loop of dying and coming back again. Yeah, but
he's not reaching that level of like, this vampire is so old, he can like glamour other vampires, and like I want like a bad day vampire, you know, like
that is still pretty much von Zarovich. The problem is he's imprisoned, both, you know, literally and figuratively. He's literally prisoned in Barovia and then figuratively prisoned by his own actions. Also in D&D, the way it's set up, that niche of unstoppable undead menace is occupied by the liches.
The lich is the very bad news.
That's where Acerorak and Vecna, to a lesser extent,
because I know Lady Vol, I know Acerorak, Vecna, and are there any of the liches?
Mark plays him in my freaking show, and they're like the Aslan. Aslan,
right. Aslan, you're right. Oh my gosh,
I'm literally can see his face. I'm like, oh, yeah. But you know, you kind of the high level undead menace becomes those guys, you know. Which is, if there were a way for Strahd to get loose, I think he would be a more compelling adversary. But if Strahd were to get loose, he'd no longer be Strahd. So.
Yeah. He'd be like kind of a reformed guy, and be like, I'm just gonna go on hikes.
So let's say you're running a game that deals with this. How would you have vampires, full vampires, be created in a game that you were running? If it was up to you to write that lore,
I had to. I would do one of two things. Either you show up and they're already a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would do the three bite thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I would say that probably I would stick pretty close to the traditional mythos of vampires, although, you know, vampiric folklore varies from all over the world. A lot of people don't know that the very first vampires were actually in Sumeria. But they straight up ate flesh. Like, this idea of they only drink blood is a Victorian idea.
Mm-hmm.
And Sumerian vampires could detach their heads, right, and had wings or something like that. Yep. Like, yep, that's what I'm looking for.
Yep. In the Victorian times is when you start getting into, Bram Stoker's portrayal of Dracula, when vampires started becoming more of an analog for sex. The fangs penetrating the flesh was a stand-in for other physical penetration that they couldn't really talk about openly, because, you know, pre Bram Stoker, vampires weren't sexy; they were just another monster. You know, like, I mean, you were a corpse that thirsted for the blood of the living. You know, there was nothing hot about that.
Yeah, vampires were very much like a symbol, like with Carmilla. Yeah,
like Nosferatu and stuff like that.
Nosferatu, that would have been like, yeah, I think, so, in folklore, well, the those idea predate
of that kind of creature, I would say.
Yeah, Nosferatu, which is German vampires, same principle. Mm-hmm. You know, the first movie that was made glossed onto that particular portrayal of the creature in the mythos, and that's why people kind of know that version of the vampire. But that's how it was over there. Would, you know, sneak, come in the window at night while you were sleeping and murder your face, you know? So,
all right.
But again, it was not hot.
All right. I got another question to hit you with then, because it goes like exactly into, you know, what we're discussing here. So, High Five Ninja asks, do you think that vampires should try harder to maintain aspects of their origins, or do you prefer the way things have been going with their modern interpretations? I think he means, like, should the way that they're shown...
I'm going to give you two very different and seemingly contradictory answers.
Okay. Hit me.
Yeah. There's a very handy wiki. If you Google vampire traits, there's a Wikipedia page. It literally has like a spreadsheet of details about vampires from all over the world, and how they were portrayed and what works on them. Does a stake through the heart work? I always love when people say things like cutting off their heads is effective against a vampire. I'm like, cutting off their heads is effective against everything. Like, what are you talking about? You know?
Like removing the heart is like, yeah, duh.
Yeah, no, that's statistically speaking, that's going to work.
Tyrion and Kenan Adams will kill it. It's like, whoa, no, yes, it's Adams now. Exactly. Of course it's going to die.
Yeah, it's susceptible to fire. Yes, so am I. Yeah, right. I think if you were going for a particular cultural expression of what a vampire is, especially to set your work aside from and make it stand out from the default sexy vampire that we've all come to accept, because that's our cultural expression of what vampires are now. It's Anne Rice, you know, it's Louis and Lestat. That's what vampires are to us. When that has not been what they were for like most of time. That being said, the contradictory part of this, and this is the part that sounds weird, is I always believe that, you know, most folklore comes from something, especially most enduring folklore. When over centuries or thousands of years, people are telling you, like, no, this is in the woods. This happens. I mean, something was out there. Something was happening. So I don't necessarily know that it's somebody that is going to detach their head and it's going to fly at you with wings. But, you know, there was something out in the woods was jacking people in the Buchenwald, you know, the 7th century. So
it's like, oh, like, and it's the idea of being able to give face to phenomenons, you know, like. That's what we do, you know, as storytellers. Human storytelling is a part of what we are. Like, people that deny that are insane. We have to do it. That gives us the ability to turn these things that are amorphous and without form, rationality, and helps us deal with stuff, you know? That's why the game of Dungeons & Dragons, or tabletops in general, they've persisted no matter how much they've been trying to be destroyed. And, like, when it comes to the idea of, like, the thing in the forest or whatever, the thing that bumps in the night, it's just, they're probably mundane, you know, very likely a mundane reason for that. But them saying, like, it's this and that helps people, you know, gives us the idea, like, well, this would work against it. It gives us a sort of a defense mechanism in a way, you know?
I'll say two things. One, for my money, storytelling is what makes us human. The fact that we can sit around the fire and share stories with each other and take actionable, life-altering information from it, that we can talk about the labors of Hercules and take some insight into what it means for our own lives, is why we're the dominant species on the planet. I mean, in the fullness of time, when we find out what crows and dolphins and elephants are really saying to each other, maybe they're telling stories too. But right now, every other thing we think makes us special, some other creature does except that. Now, to your point about it was probably something mundane, I wholly reject that, because these are the people that lived in those environments. I mean, they were completely aware of what a bear is and what a wolf is and what it means to get bitten by a snake. And when they're like, no, it's a different thing. We and this is the inheritance of a Western worldview, because I'm going to get in that, that, you know, our Western worldview is built on the idea that we are the single greatest, best and brightest thing of all time right now. And civilization and society is only moving forward and up. Mm. So as we are going upwards, we look down on everyone else that came before or lives differently than us. So it's very easy for people who've never been to the woods to be like, it was just a bear. And they're like, bitch, I know what a bear is.
It's very easy to look back and be like, oh, this is ridiculous. Because it's the idea of like the thing of assuming I'm being rational, you know?
Yep.
Like, well, I'm being rational, you know? Like, oh, like it obviously has to be. I believe it had to be something, right? Because that's what science and everything has told me. It has to be something mundane. But I'm not going to say to this person, like, if someone came to me and it was like, yo, you're not going to believe this, but there's a four-armed creature in the woods throwing people really high up in the air and letting them hit the floor and they die. You know, and be like, that sounds crazy, but I'm not going to tell you you're wrong. You saw it.
Let me be very clear about what it is that I'm claiming here. To your previous point, if you just hear something crunching in the woods, yeah, overwhelmingly likely it is something normal, you know, and your mind can play tricks on you. All of 1,000% with you there. I'm saying when these stories persist for centuries or thousands of years of people being like, no, it is this thing.
There has to be
what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think the earliest vampire story was
something's out back in the back of the house. It must be a werewolf. It's like, no, it's probably a deer. Like, it's probably a dog. Yeah.
I think the earliest vampire story is like, what, 1500 BC, something like that.
Something like that.
Sumerian, yeah. So that's around that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. Back. If you hang on, is this what I'm after? You can Google a list of vampire traits in folklore and fiction, and it'll come up with a pretty interesting chart of like, you know, what they. Oh, actually, hang on, that's not what I'm talking about. That's the one that is just in stories. Like, hang on, I'll find it. I don't want you to listen to me. I'm in an in here.
All right, so I mean, as far as my own, I don't think that we really need to fight too much with keeping to classic lore. I don't know if this question was born out of like Twilight, you know, and how they kind of just take the whole of the vampire lore and throw it on its head for you know, the purposes of this teenage romance. It feels like the question may have come from that, but I'm not sure. When it comes to massive departures like that, I do feel like maybe someone should maybe just consider naming this new thing something else rather than saying it's a vampire, but all of what you know about vampires is wrong. Because at that point, it's like, what's the point? You know, why are we calling it a vampire at that point?
I get you.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Hold on, might be
Dave. I was going to say ultraviolet, where they were hemophages. You know, like you're 3/4 through the movie before you're like, wait a minute, these are vampires? Yeah, so.
Yeah. I forgot about that movie.
It's very true that,
the best.
Like, you know, like, just have certain traits, you know, certain things are part of, you know, like, that's like an argument that can be made is like, people are like, oh, Naruto, those act like ninjas. It's like, well, they use ninjutsu at least, you know, that's enough to get it by, you know, but like, use certain traits that make, like, oh, they're the sunlight thing, the blood, and maybe the strength and speed, you know, like, try to keep those.
Well, you know, those are the major through lines, that, yeah.
Yeah, like, and like, you don't have to do the whole water running thing, because I didn't know that for a long time, actually. And maybe the invitation. And other than that, you know, you could change them up however you want. But like, just because different settings require different characters, obviously. So you have to change things to make your own story somewhat. But like, if I'm saying this guy's a vampire, but he shoots fireballs and he has a raccoon's tail, it's like, what about him as a vampire? He doesn't even eat people, you know?
Yeah, that's I agree. I think there's room for your interpretation of a mythos,
mm-hmm.
But when you just do things like, say, we hide in the dark because we sparkle in the sunshine, I mean, that's just dumb. You know what I mean? I guess Stephanie Meyer made a couple of dollars off of it, but it's just like, what? You know? Yeah, I agree. But I mean, as long as you have some reason and rationale and you remain internally consistent, like I tell people this about storytelling all the time, you can do whatever you want after you establish the rules of your universe, as long as you remain consistent with the rules of your universe. Bugs Bunny can reach behind his back and pull out a mallet and hit you with it. We accept that. Superman can fire laser beams out of his eyes. We accept that. If Superman pulled a mallet from behind his back and hit you with it, we're like, what are you doing? You
know? Had that back for the whole time? What's going on? Yeah.
So it's just remain consistent, at least, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. The Twilight vampires are a treat. My girlfriend loved those books. And I've seen like all the movies, and I read like two of the books because obviously I was a young boy, and young boys would do anything.
Yeah.
Do anything.
To impress young girls. Yep.
Yeah. We'll do anything. Yep. We have no honor yet. We don't get it. So I remember my girlfriend right now, she read those books. And she was like, oh, I love Twilight so much. I want to go back and give it a read. And she read through like half the first book. And I've never seen such self-disappointment. She was like, I thought this was good. What was wrong with me? And I was like, you're young, you know?
From what I understand, and I've had multiple people tell me this, I will say I still can't find this dang chart that I'm looking for, but if you Google vampiric folklore by region, there's a great Wikipedia page. It'll tell you like how vampires stories have been told all over the world. But anyhow, about True Blood, one of the things that I've heard more than once is Stephanie Meyer's really captured what it felt like to be a teenage girl in love. You know, all the rest of it was secondary. Because if you think about it, the premise is laughable. That it's like, I'm like 120 years old, but I only date 18-year-olds. I'm like, I'm 44 and I wouldn't want an 18-year-old. What are you talking about?
That's terrifying.
Exactly. Like that. I mean, even let's just stop right there. But, you know, a lot of these things, you know, True Blood began as an actual Vampire the Masquerade campaign. Charlaine Harris was a storyteller for Vampire that used to be on YouTube, and once the book started getting published, it got pulled down. Fifty Shades of Grey began as Twilight fan fiction. As far as I know, Stephanie Myers didn't play, but I mean, again, it's been ubiquitous. It was impossible to get away from this. But you know, it's I'm trying not to yuck anybody's yums, but I will go down a haterish path if we keep talking about True Blood and dogs and imprinting on a baby and all that other nonsense.
Well, let's talk about. I got another question here as far as like internal lore remaining, you know, and kind of internally consistent. Jack the Giant Killer asks, do you like the looser lore of Requiem, or are you purely a Masquerade stan?
Masquerade.
Can you expound upon that? Because I have opinions, but my microphone or my connection is not quite as good.
The Werewolf the Apocalypse, Vampire the Masquerade, Mage the Ascension, Changeling the Dreaming, the first ones for me, you know?
Changeling the Dreaming is my favorite.
Yep, it's it's not so bad as like 4th edition, which we do not speak of. I think those were all valid expressions of the games, and I got a lot of friends that's what they played first and that's what they loved the most, but I'm an OG.
Yeah.
And although I will say Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition is the best version of the game to date, though, out of all of them.
Is it based off 5e for the most part, or is it a 5th edition of Vampire the Masquerade?
No, it's unrelated. It just so happens it's also the 5th edition of Vampire. Yeah. Yep.
I think they really handled the advancement of time after Gehenna very effectively.
You know, it's the issue is, and I have to be careful because I have a lot more visibility into the thought process that goes into the World of Darkness than some other properties. So to be careful what I can and can't say. What I will say is I believe the thing that they've done the worst job of over time is it was always implied that even the books for vampire were unreliable because vampires lie. That you could read these books and you can't be sure if it's true. But unless you just hit people over the head with that repeatedly, that's not how people interact with this content. You don't pick up the Curse of Strahd and read it and be like, well, maybe that's not what happened, you know? And you're like, no, that's what happened. It says it right there, you know? So to have it be like, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So for people that don't have a background in this also, so you had the World of Darkness games coming out of the 90s. And when White Wolf was going out of business, all of these games were centered around a very bad thing that was about to happen.
Some sort of end times narrative.
Yeah. Exactly, an imminent apocalypse that your characters were fighting to try and prevent. And so when White Wolf was going out of business, they wrote endings for all of these games where it happened. And the bad thing happened. The apocalypse happened. Henna happened. The long winter happened. Like, everything happened. And then after that, other companies, thankfully, kind of picked up these IPs and brought them back to life again. And they couldn't just ignore the fact that, you know, that the end of the world came. So it sort of was like, oh, well, now what? Well, it was kind of this. Well, it was kind of that. Maybe it really meant this. Maybe it really meant that. And it was just sort of like, okay, you know? Like, all right, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the big things I've had with Vampire the Masquerade is I always felt like it was best run in the context of the 80s.
The universe is just intent on not letting you contribute to this conversation.
it's insane.
It's only when he's like, let me tell you what I think, and it's like, what if you didn't?
Yeah, what if we just shut you up right now?
As soon as the interview's over, though, I bet it'll be crystal clear.
Oh, yeah. It was crystal clear right before, too. I don't know if we're connected again.
I can hear you currently.
All right, so I'll try and make it quick. I always really thought that Masquerade was best told in the 80s and 90s, just because the limitations for technology really helped create conflict and challenges for the characters, you know. So once you kind of had an internet take over and become ubiquitous in society, it made certain parts of the game seem less interesting.
I can verify the technology makes it harder to be a vampire, yes.
Definitely.
Yes.
Definitely. Somebody using their smartphone and being like, yo, why, like, are eight people behind you have, like, don't show up on the selfie? And it's like, we're there.
Can verify. It comes up with some unintended complications. Yes.
Yeah, it was one of the few things I think Requiem handled better for a little while, anyway.
Yeah, I'm not anti-Requiem. Like, I'm anti-fourth edition. I'm not anti-Requiem. You know, just wasn't my jam.
It had a great system. Its lore was just not very deep, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't particularly well told in terms of that lore.
I think it was. I won't say it was a patch to bridge over to something else because there was no guarantee that it was going to be something else. But it was just it was a heroic and ultimately successful, I'd even say, attempt at just keeping the mythos alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it worked.
Yeah. I've on occasion run Masquerade games, like the Masquerade lore, but with the system of Requiem. And it's actually been very fun to do. Because I thought the Requiem game system was very, very clean. And when it comes to running games, I actually had a question specifically here for you, B-Dave. When it comes from Blood Countess Abendroth, when planning a VTM chronicle, roughly how much do you plan it out plot-wise versus how much of it is just improvising and going with the flow? Advantages and disadvantages, and also...
Well, there's two different questions to ask there. When you say chronicle, depends on if it's a stream or a home game. Because if it's a stream, you probably have a limitation of the episodes in the season, and you have to plan around that. Mm. If it's a home game, you don't necessarily have that constraint. And neither of those things are you know, set in stone. At the height of my Patreon, I was running about 35 to 40 games a month. And most of those were vampire games. So what would end up happening in that context, at the beginning of the session, I would have a rough idea what was going to happen that session and what I was setting up overall. Like, I knew I had this new force was coming into the city, or these machinations were playing out. And I would try and sprinkle those seeds out in such a way that would come to a meaningful head at a time that I decided. For a stream, honestly, it's the same thought process. If I know I have 10 episodes, then something interesting has to happen every week. But I look at it as I give it act breaks, like a movie has. That, I mean, if you know, then roughly 3 episodes are act 1, roughly 4 episodes are act 2, roughly 3 episodes are the finale. And so I plan significant seismic events to kind of happen along the lines at those beats. But even if I have an idea of what's going to happen, I plan the beginning of an episode roughly where it should be by the midpoint and roughly where it should be by the end. But I don't really plan anything in the second half, because both the dice and the players will surprise and betray you. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to be ready to just yes and go with them wherever they go. Mm-hmm. It's like having a destination in mind, but not necessarily having a route planned out. So it's kind of a bit of both.
And for home games, which direction does that shift in?
More improv and more on the fly. Most of what I'm doing is improv. Even when I have a plan, it's still improv. Mm-hmm. So it's so much of it is off the top of the dome in the moment. To do the the Stranger Things game that you just saw me do.
Yeah.
I had just an idea of roughly where it was going to start and roughly where it was going to go. Most of that which you see happening, I'm doing in real time and making up as I'm going along. Most of it.
It seemed like they really enjoyed that. So, I mean, it can't be a bad approach. Does that change between game systems for you, like VTM versus D&D?
No. Because I can do any of that stuff blindfolded, because I've been doing it so long and know it so well, you know. I think a lot of times people over prepare, because the problem is when you over prepare, you unintentionally put guardrails on the story. And you start railroading people towards a certain thing or to do a certain thing, or they must go a certain way, when you have to be prepared to adjust to what it is the people at the table want to do and what they think is fun.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Swain, you run a home game. Mm-hmm. How do you handle it?
Planning and improv, what I do is I do outlines pretty much. Mm-hmm. So I do pretty much a roadmap of, we start in Big City, Waterdeep, Baldur's Gate, Sharn, somewhere in Greyhawk, and then I do beats based on levels. So pretty much like when we finish this mission that we mainly had to do, level up there, and then I kind of go with the flow until we get to higher levels. When it gets to higher levels, obviously, past like level, I would say 8, there's more exposition and freedom in how the people want to tackle things. But I do a little bit of planning every session, but I keep the main focus on these certain checkpoints I lay out throughout the game. I keep it really simple, because I've done a whole like week of writing, mm-hmm. and my friends come and they railroad it, and it's just all that time gone.
How do you feel about like that? That kind of idea that it's about 2 hours of planning to every 1 hour of game time.
Yeah, that seems about right for me. I usually, like right now I'm trying to run a little one shot, and I've spent about like maybe 10 hours sort of like figuring it out, figuring out the map I'm going to use, and all that junk. And now I would say it's probably going to be about like a 5-hour campaign. So yeah, that seems about right.
B Dave, I wanted to ask you, do you have a preference for a system that you're running these days?
No. I mean, I'm lead designer of End of the Motherlands, so I've been making that actively every day. I'm just because of the way the fates have broken currently, I'm playing a lot more D&D than I'm playing a vampire, but I used to be playing a lot more vampire than I was playing a D&D. I've run about 600 games of V5. I've run more games of vampire V5 than anybody else on Earth. I would say more than anybody, period, but there's some cats I'm sure have been playing weekly games since 95, so...
oh, yeah.
But those, are the champions, man.
Yeah, but definitely a fifth edition. So, yeah, it's all about what's the story that you're trying to tell, really, you know? Because Vampire the Masquerade is a good system for a highly narrative-driven modern experience. Fifth edition is good for it's never completely shaken its war game roots, so it's good if you're going to do something very fighty, but the further you deviate from being fighty, the more the system kind of strains to keep up with you. But no preference either way.
Now, have you run many games of Dark Ages or Victorian for vampire?
Dark Ages is actually my favorite. It is actually my favorite vampire setting. And I did a series of short games on Q-Times where we did Vampire, Werewolf, Mage, Wraith, and Changeling that were all tied together.
I love that.
It was leading towards a finale that I just have never had time to get the band back together again and do the finale for. I still have it in the back of my head what was going to happen. I will say the Wraith, the Oblivion... 4-episode series we did for Q-Times is like the most intense and astonishing game that I've ever been a part of still. Like, that was wild. I've still not experienced anything like that before or since.
Wow.
That's for people who aren't aware. So again, Vampire, Werewolf, Mage, Wraith, and Changeling were all in, that was the World of Darkness, and they all existed in continuity. Vampire and Werewolf, you know. Changeling, you were Fae, but like Fae from the real fairy tales, like Dark Fae. Like, don't mess with them because they'll eat you, Fae. In Wraith, you were ghosts, literal ghosts. And Mage is the Matrix. Like, Mage is the Matrix so much so that you'll never convince me that the Wachowskis did not play a lot of Mage growing up making that, because it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So with Wraith, you're a ghost, you have unfinished business, something that is keeping you from moving on, but you also have something that is called the shadow. The shadow is not your evil twin. The shadow is you. The shadow is everything you're not proud of, every mistake you ever made, every secret you ever kept, everything that you don't like about yourself is your shadow, and your shadow hates you. and so at the table, you're playing your mage in someone else's, or your wraith rather, in someone else's shadow. So there's a PvP component to it of where you're actively trying to undo another person, but then like temporarily you actually can help them at times because you're ultimately trying to lead them to their destruction. And the things they said and did in that game, I was just like, wow. Like, there were so many times I had to just cover my face so I didn't ruin a very intense scene, because I was just like, I can't believe they did that. Jesus. So yeah, that was a...
I'm going to have to go find that. That sounds awesome.
It was Wraith Echoes of New York that we did for Q-Time. So check that out.
That sounds really cool.
Tell me a little bit about Ventru stuff. I want to... You said that this was your favorite clan, and because we talked a little bit before, you know, over Twitter and stuff, and I had asked you, you know, obviously what was your favorite clan, and you said it was, of course, Ventru. So I want to hear a bit about what draws you to the Ventru clan in VTM.
Clan of Kings. Yeah, all the way back into college, I was I would play Ventru, where, you know, most people wanted to be Gangrel and Nosferatu and have the big teeth and claws, and that was, you know, the trench coat katana guy thing where it was really in vogue then.
The old fish malks too, yeah.
Yep,
nice,
yep.
Nice.
But I liked Klee and Ventru because they're the guy behind the guy. They're the power. I mean, oftentimes they're on the throne, but if they're not on the throne, they're the power behind the throne. I like the fact that it's, you know, that they have been the leaders since time immemorial and the ones that actually make things happen, which is not always the most sexy thing on the front of it, especially when you can be like a Toreador filled with all we or any of that stuff. Just being the one that is moving the pieces on the chessboard, that was always the most interesting thing to me. In recent years, I've developed a true and deep and abiding love for Clan La Sombra.
Okay. But,
yeah, that's I like all the clans. There's no clans I don't like.
I can see the parallels between Ventru and La Sombra there in terms of like the themes that run between them. So that makes sense.
Well, in the past, Ventru were political power and La Sombra were religious power. Mm-hmm. In the modern Knights, that line is not quite so clear on either side of it. You know, for people that don't know, the Ventru are the business vampires. And it used to be just the you know, the sleazy stockbroker Wolf of Wall Street cliche was how everybody saw them. And when LA by Night was coming back, which what the point of the show was to introduce 5th edition of Vampire to a new generation of fans, I took very seriously the fact that I was going to be the face of the Clan of Kings and wanted to help redefine that, which is why I was so adamant in the early seasons, for a lot of reasons, that my character Victor had made his money from just being a smart businessman and not from crime. And I asked myself, because I was coming off of We're Alive Frontier, where I was the reluctant leader of an unruly band of misfits who wouldn't listen to their detriment. So I came into Vampire being like, well, what kind of vampire would actually be having a good time being a vampire? And I'm like, a nightclub promoter. You know, that's somebody like, this is great. That so that's where that came from originally. And it was both as a Ventru and as being a black male. I did not want to go into the cliche of rap and hip hop equals crime. So I was adamant that, like, he didn't sell drugs, didn't do any of those things. He was just smart. Now, over the fullness of the show, I did lots of crime, but I did crime in the context of being a vampire.
That's how you offset it. Exactly. Yeah, we learn at a young age. We got to offset it a little bit. You know, you got to be like, oh, well, I'll do bad things, but not because of this. I'm just bad.
Yeah, exactly. I think I succeeded in showing the people, you know, the different ways that the clan and leadership and all those things could manifest.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So another thing, you mentioned it earlier. I kind of want to be here for this. Could you possibly try and sell Sween on Clan Gangrel?
Oh, let's hear it. What's their deal?
So, Gangrel are the wildest vampires. They are still the closest to nature. Most of them actually live outside. Some of them still live in the woods. All the vampires and werewolves don't get along, but werewolves and Gangrel specifically don't get along because they're like, why are you out here in the woods? What are you doing? They have a lot of the abilities. They have an ability called Protean, which is shape-shifting. So they can do things like grow teeth and claws. They can turn into wolves or, you know, giant owls, things of that nature. And so a lot of the wildness and ferocity and rage that is present in a werewolf is very much present in Clan Gangrel, to the point that a lot of other vampires don't like them. Because they are wild and unruly and very much do their own thing.
That sounds cool. Yeah. That sounds definitely like something. I like the free nature of what you're describing. I like them being like, you kind of just do what we want. We don't really care what anybody else says or thinks.
Yeah, if I was running a game, this is the direction I'd be pushing you in. you know, if you were to be at the table with me. So
if I one day I've definitely watched Vampire the Masquerade like a lot, like when it was just being like pushed on Giga Sundry, I watched it like often because I was interested. I was like, I have to at least, because I'm one of the kind of guys that if I don't like something, I want to know exactly why I don't like it. I want to understand why I don't like it, because most things are not really worth truly disliking. So I absorbed and absorbed, and I was like, this seems very, very cool. But these are vampires.
Obviously, you know, zone of safety. You're allowed to be into what you're into, you know, and there's a chicken for every pot, such as it is. But what the point behind the world of darkness and what makes it beautiful in the midst of its terror is the world of darkness is this world. The gas station on the corner is there. City Hall is there. Your house is there. Everything you know and love exists. Just 30% of the people are monsters.
30%. That's not too bad.
So it's like, what do you do, you know, knowing that when you yourself, you personally, because that's actually one of the first ways that I introduce people to the game is you personally, you know, tonight you wake up in a pool of your own sweat in your bed and there's two bite marks on your neck and action, we're in. You know, most vampires don't know who their sires are anyway. And it's just like, what would you personally do? You wake up and you're racked with this mind-numbing hunger and like drive to consume, and you look down at your hands and you have these long claws and sharp fangs, but someone's knocking on the door and you know it's your girlfriend. Now what? Man, That's vampire.
That's okay. You sold me. You eventually just sold me.
I am going to hit you with this final question that was
part. Finish strong.
Yeah, that was part of this last question that we had. What about are we going to be seeing an LA by Night source book coming soon, as far as 5th edition goes?
You know, I open my mouth and red lasers start appearing all over me from the Second Inquisition. So okay. I get shot up with NDA bullets.
Perfect. Perfect answer. Okay, so that tells us everything we need to know right there. Now, real quick, I want you to just like throw out any stuff that you want to promote, anything that you want to call attention to, and then Sween will basically take us out.
Yeah, they again just did the Stranger Things one shot where I ran D&D for the cast, which is on Netflix, Twitch, and YouTube, which was a lot of fun. Check that out.
You did a great job, man. That was wild.
Thank you.
Yeah. Wild situation. I can't believe you did that. Awesome.
I appreciate it. It was a whole lot of fun. And then Wednesday nights, Legends of the Multiverse on D&D, Twitch, and YouTube. Thursday nights, Black Dice Society, my show on D&D, Twitch, and YouTube. And all sorts of random things here and there. And you can find me all over the interwebs, wherever fine streaming content can be located, at B. Dave Walters.
Well, thank you guys for tuning in to yet another episode of Legends and Lore. Thank you, B. Dave, again for stopping by. As always, a pleasure. And we will be seeing you guys soon. Later.